Good afternoon, really, but, yep. Let's see here. Are you each going to argue?
No, I am.
Okay, thank you. If you want to...
Yes, sir.
Oh, and if you want to put your name on the record, though, or your appearance.
H. Joel Newman.
I'm sorry, I guess if you said that, I didn't hear you. H. Joel Newman, thank you.
And
all right.
Jonathan Frank for the showrooms, Lumister Filter, and Filter Depot in the office.
All right, thank you. We'll have you do that again when you're here, but go on. Counselor, your name, please.
Yes, ma'am, please, the court. Mark Rossman on behalf of Edward Castle, the appellant in this matter, and Cross Appellee. Your Honor, this case highlights what I view as one of the most substantial threats to a close corporation, and that is the succession of power, which, as the facts of this case show, can be an extremely turbulent event in the life of a corporation and very often lead to the death of the business. Recently, I moderated and presented at the Michigan State Bar's Forum in Grand Rapids on the issue of business succession planning, and I heard that the statistics are that approximately one-third of businesses, close corporations, fail when power transfers from one generation to the next, and that's usually due to an absence of good succession planning. The Filter Depot in this case is no exception to that. There was no plan in place to account for the arrival of Bill Down's daughter and son-in-law, who, as the record shows in this case, considered their power quite limitless, as majority owners often do. The company's failure and demise is directly correlated to the drastic corporate action taken by the Shohams and MAF in the months subsequent to which they arrived. In this case, we have a once successful business that started to fail simultaneously with the arrival of the Shohams, who are the owners of Midwest Air Filter, which is the majority owner of the Filter Depot. The record shows that the company had just come off of its most successful year in its history, 2012, with business profits approaching $200,000. And the Shohams arrived in early 2013, and the profits for that year plummeted by over 50% to $99,747. The following year, we see the company dip into showing an $81,000 loss on its tax returns. What happened? How did this business take such a sharp how did this business hit such a sharp decline after the majority partner passed away and his successors took over? And the record in this case gives us the answer. The first, and let's assume for sake of argument, there's some discussion in the court's opinion regarding the corporate formalities and what the operating agreement required in terms of a vote or disclosures on consents. And let's assume for a minute that all of those procedural nuances are not in dispute here, that we're not having disagreeing over whether there should have been a vote over self-dealing, which the judge found, and that self-dealing involving raising the management fees by 6 times in the first year, and that there's no dispute over whether the form of the capital call notice was correct or incorrect. Put those issues aside, and we can assume for sake of argument that the operating agreement was followed in those respects, because when we look at what the substance of what this controlling majority did here, it's what drove the company into perpetual financial loss, which is where it was at the time of trial and where it's at today. So we start with, there's a rocky start between the new partners who come together as a result of Mr. Down's death. And suffice it to say, it was a bit of a frosty relationship. And I think the reasons for that were fleshed out in the trial court's opinion and in both parties' briefs. On the one hand, we have Ed Castle, who wasn't keen on his new partner's management style. And on the other hand, the new controlling majority wasn't keen on sharing half of the profits on the Detroit, on the sales that were made in the Detroit market. From their perspective, it would have been better to integrate 100% of those profits into the larger Midwest Air Filter enterprise. And that's why, jumping ahead in the case below, they actually moved to dissolve the company, which would have done away with all of it and left the business for Midwest Air Filter to service. Fortunately, Judge Viviano denied that motion, but it's that intent that was carried out in the facts and events leading up to this case. So step one, what they do here, and I see this pattern repeating in cases like this, is get the money out of the company. Get it out of the company because it gets it away from the majority, or the minority partner, rather. And this is what's called in some of the unpublished cases on oppression as funneling. So they funnel the money. It drives it into insolvency. This is just such a stark example of funneling money out of the company in this case. Within less than 4 months, the management fees, and it's management fees not pursuant to a contract with terms that were negotiated or disclosed or with a consent that authorized entry into a contract. It's just the payment of management fees pursuant to a consent resolution. And they were increased by 6 times, from 2% to 14% of sales, of the total sales. And we see them jump from $28,000 to $200,000 annualized. And they're basically saying, in this scenario, and this is the basis on which the court found that these fees were fair, and I submit the court erred, they say, here's our costs. They need to be paid. This is Midwest speaking. And by the way, these costs equate to 100% of your profits. So this move immediately drove the company straight into the red, 100% of the profits. That is not a deal that any sane business enterprise would enter into. Let's have somebody store inventory and move our product. And by the way, the cost to us is 100% of our product. And I'll get to the nuances a little bit further down the line on how this is particularly unfair, because the vendor, in this case Midwest, who was a manager and a member of the company, was imposing fixed costs. And there's some debate in the record below and a suggestion in the opinion that while there might have been an agreement to impose just incremental costs to pass those on to the purchaser of these products, the filter services, the filter depot, to say that you pass on your incremental or your non-incremental, your fixed costs also, is inherently not an arm's-length transaction, because nobody would ever purchase services pursuant to a formula that required the purchaser to buy a portion of the executive salaries, the rent, the trucks, everything that was already there and already being used. And I can talk about that a little bit more down the line. But they moved the money out. Then they put the squeeze on the minority partner. And they do it by saying, well, since we have no money left, since it costs so much money to run this business and we're in the red here, you're going to have to pay us to keep the business going. We're all going to pay.
Does that matter, given that he never actually came forward with the money?
It matters, and it matters for several reasons.
Okay, tell me.
The first matter, just from a legal perspective, I believe it's a significant issue, because out-of-pocket money damages are not necessary to trigger a claim for an equitable remedy under this equitable statute. And we find the authority for that in the most recent Supreme Court case in this area, and that's the Frank v. Linkner case. It dealt with the statute of limitations and principally when a claim accrues under the shareholder statute or the member oppression statute. And in that case, and I know because I wrote the briefs in the Court of Appeals, we argued that the claim didn't accrue until the damages were realized, because there was some corporate action. It was amendments to corporate governance documents that then, fast forward 3 years later, when the company was sold, it affected the distribution and dispossessed several of the plaintiff members of any money. It was all gone because people basically took cuts in front of them. And what I argued in the Court of Appeals, and it was subsequently reversed in the Supreme Court, was that it didn't accrue until the damages arose. In the Linkner case, and there's a line, and I cited in my brief the relevant language, it held no. The claim accrued when the corporate action was taken that constituted the oppressive conduct, irrespective of the damages. So I believe that we can apply that precedent in this case to argue that the act of issuing notice of a capital call, which actually contains...
Okay, so spin that out. So let's say hypothetically we were to agree that that's oppressive conduct on the part of Midwest. Then what?
Okay. So I'll skip the reasons why it would be oppressive, the fraud that's intrinsic in it and the false statement that it was paid.
Right.
The reason that it would be an act of oppression is because under the subsequent section to the operating agreement, I believe it's 3.3, it triggers a right on the part of the controlling membership to seek forfeiture and damages against the minority member if they don't pay. So there actually has been an injury realized at that point in time when the money is not paid. And we see that...
Well, did they seek forfeiture or damages?
They actually just sought it a few... While they seek it in the trial court case, that they're appealing the court's decision that the capital call can't be enforced against our clients. So, yes, they did seek it in the case below, and they reasserted that remedy against my client just recently, and that was in the Macomb County Circuit Court where a new case was filed, and that was the pleadings in that case were just made part of the record. And the complaint in that case involves a request for forfeiture of shares based on the fact that several capital call demands were issued in the range of about $7,000 each.
So you're asking us then to say that a request for forfeiture that came subsequent to this case concluding demonstrates that there was that an oppressive capital call is actionable?
Not necessarily. I think that if we're looking on the record before us outside of what's happened recently, it diminishes the act of there being the capital call that wasn't complied with diminished the value of Mr. Castle's shareholding interests because he became subject to that relief, which was sought in the circuit court in the trial below, and it was denied. It was properly denied, and now it's on cross appeal. So my position on that would be, and it's consistent with the Frank decision, is that there was an impairment of his shareholder interests by virtue of that capital call, and damage to him in the form of lost value of those shares because of the consequent effect of that. Now, if I just might turn briefly back to the capital call, there are two components of that capital call that are important. One I just mentioned, and it's the statement that Midwest, who issued the capital call, paid approximately $250,000 as their capital share. That's a false statement. That fact alone, I would be comfortable walking into this court with just that fact on my side and arguing that triggers oppression because of the word fraud in the oppression statute. Now, when it came to the common law analysis of fraud, I think that the court...
Back up a little bit and just reset the factual parameters of that. I'm just not remembering it all clearly.
So the capital call is issued.
Right.
And it's for $167,000 against Ed Castle and $37,000 against his son for a total of $204,000.
Mm-hmm.
There's some debate in the briefs on what the percentage allocations are, but suffice it to say it's a $204,000 request.
Mm-hmm.
The record shows that the method by which that was computed was not based on any legitimate need. And I think that fact is shown just by the largesse of the demand. $204,000 is quite a lot of money for a capital call when they're not purchasing a capital asset. It's for day-to-day operations. So it's big. in connection with, so, and but the methodology was defined for us in the testimony, and it was when Mr. Shoham testified. How did we come up with this? Well, you'd think it would be, and I've seen this in other cases, you know, they commission a report to see how much something costs, you know, you buy some land or a building or something, and here's how much we need, you all have to put in. If you don't, you're basically out of here. We're going to forfeit your shares, we'll make the capital call, and you go away. In this case, there was none of that. Instead, the methodology that it was based on was they tallied up the last 5 years of distributions that Mr. Castle and or his son received, consistent with their shareholding interest, and then basically asked for it back. And in the capital call notice, they said, and by the way, our share of that, because the capital call goes out to all shareholders, not just some of them, in a corporation where there's not separate classes of stock, as for our share, Midwest's share, we already paid that. So
the same amount?
No, it was a pro rata. And I don't have the
So it would be a little more than 250.
Yeah, I think, yes.
Maybe two, yeah.
I think it was 257. I may stand corrected on that, but it was in the range of a, might have been 250.
Because for it to be a legitimate capital call, it would have to be shared equally by the shareholder.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
exactly.
Each share, the, okay.
Exactly.
But you're saying they actually didn't kick in, whatever their share was, they didn't kick it in.
Correct. And that was shown by, if I recall correctly, Ms. Rigler, Mr. Castle's expert testified that the contribution wasn't showing on the tax returns, and it would have been had it been made. And now,
was there contrary evidence?
To be honest with you, Your Honor, there was some discussion in the briefs of how loans were accounted for, and I couldn't glean from the books were in shambles. They commingled accounts. There were certain things that weren't on the financial statements, and the evidence established that at trial. Counsel made some arguments in his brief that I didn't quite follow, and so I will say that I don't believe there's any evidence in the record that supports the notion that Midwest Air Filter made its capital contribution.
Okay, I want to make sure I understand you. You said there was discussion about how loans were accounted for. Does that mean that there was evidence of loans presented?
We found our expert testified that there was a loan on the books.
Okay, this is a yes or no question.
Okay, Your Honor.
Was there evidence presented of the existence of loans?
Yes.
Okay. And was there testimony concerning how those loans were accounted for in the books and records?
Yes.
So as perhaps what you mean, and I could be misunderstanding you, is that you did not believe that there was credible evidence that the loans accounted for the contribution. Is that fair?
I think it's not fair because I misspoke earlier.
Okay.
When I referenced the loans, what I intended to say was that there was a loan owing by the Filter Depot to Midwest. Strike that. Give me 1 second, Your Honor, because I can get the answer for this pretty quickly.
For taxes, is that what we're talking about?
Okay, at page 19 of our brief, and I apologize. The company CPA conceded that Midwest Air Filter at one point actually owed the Filter Depot under a note receivable while the capital call was pending. And that's why I conflated the loan with the capital call, because they're asking for money to go into the company when on the books Midwest is actually owing the Filter Depot money. And it was $96,000, and it represented the net cash created in that year that was sitting in Midwest Air Filter's checking account, and that has not been distributed through the Filter Depot statement.
Okay, so then I have to ask the question again. Mm-hmm. Is it your testimony that there, is it your argument, I'm sorry, that there was no evidence, testimonial or otherwise, presented that would indicate that there was a capital contribution, whether through loans, forgiveness, loan forgiveness, advance payments, or any other entity to account for the 270 or whatever the number is?
That is correct, Your Honor.
There is zero evidence presented.
Zero evidence presented.
Okay.
So we see this situation where he's being asked to fund the company in order to pay Midwest Air Filter these increased management fees, but he didn't leave. He was being pressured to leave. In fact, he was being asked to sign an agreement that contained a release of the capital call, and which is very strong evidence that the capital call was put on him and he was asked to contribute that money and then subsequently asked to enter into a settlement agreement that released that liability. And so it was a liability that was created in order to give the majority leverage to get him to forfeit his shares, enter into a 5-year non-compete, and leave the company. He didn't leave the company. Instead, he was fired. And one of the principal reasons he was fired, as stated in his termination letter, was that he wouldn't enter into the non-compete. Now, the court erred when it held that the employment termination didn't give rise to what the case law calls disproportionate impact. As the law has developed around the question of whether the termination of employment constitutes an actionable claim under the statute, the courts look at whether there's a disproportionate impact upon them, because the mere firing with nothing else and where someone is still receiving all the benefits that are available from his or her ownership in the company doesn't trigger a claim. And I lay out some of the legislative history and the progression from the Franchino decision to the statutes in our brief. In this case, there is disproportionate impact, and there's two reasons. One is because at the time of the termination, he was receiving nothing. The distributions had been terminated, and there was no other benefit associated with this company to him other than his employment. And in fact, the value of his shareholding, which is sometimes cited by trial courts as eliminating the disproportionate impact, was eliminated also by virtue of his exposure under the capital call. And so when he was terminated, he lost the singular financial benefit that he was receiving, whereas 100% of the financial benefits are then going to Midwest Air Filter, the majority controlling member. And so there's an economic disproportionate impact. In addition to that, there's two unpublished decisions which I said in my brief. One is the Berger v. Katz case. It's a 2011 case. And the other is the Matagula v. Taub Court of Appeals case before it went up to the Supreme Court. In Matagula, the court held that there was the Matagula appeals case. And it was reversed by the Supreme Court on different grounds. It held that there should be it should be a bench trial as opposed to a judge trial, and so it was remanded to the trial court. But in the Court of Appeals, the court held that the termination disproportionately affected the interest as a shareholder because compensation was reduced to zero, and the minority member was no longer involved in decisions on material issues such as the development of the company. And in that case, the shareholder was even on the board of directors at the time that he was terminated. And so what we see here is both of those elements exist in this case. And in the Berger case, that was also a termination situation where salaries were eliminated, and the court held that there was an actionable claim for termination of employment.
You have about 6.5 minutes.
Okay.
If you wish to save some for rebuttal, I...
You know, if the court doesn't have any questions for me at this point, I would like to save another 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Oh, sure. Take the whole thing. I'm charged.
No, before I start, I don't know the court's preference on how the court wants to allocate time, since we do have a cross appeal and there were two conflicting cases.
You're going to argue whatever you're going to argue right now, and then he's got 5 minutes rebuttal left, so.
Okay.
Yep.
And the good thing about writing a fairly copious and complete brief is you have confidence that you've had an opportunity to review it.
So you're going to address all your claims right now.
Thank you. Jonathan Frank for the Scholem's Midwest Air Filter and Filter Depot in the cross appeal. Mr. Rossman started with an interesting point, so I'll start with the same point, which has to do with succession. And this was maybe a bad succession, but succession, a bad succession doesn't equal oppression. And this is an oppression case, not a failure of succession case. There's no such thing in Michigan as a failure of succession case. And we can all agree that in March of 2013, there was a bad personality clash, which probably caused quite a bit of resentment on both sides, and that's why we're here, but that's not oppression. So I want to highlight what I think are the top 10 facts that you should keep in mind, and let's put them in real time, because I think as this develops between March of 2013 and the end of 2014, you'll see why we're here and why this case ends up in litigation. So we have a death of Bill Down in March of 2013. And Bill's daughter, Marcy, and his son-in-law, Jonathan, are basically the new sheriff in town, and that's the bad succession. They come in, and by all accounts, everybody's account, they want to operate more by the book than Bill Down had. And when Bill Down had operated, Ed and his son, Dave, who were both working in the Detroit office, had a sweetheart deal because they were not recognizing expenses at the right level. And therefore, when Mr. Rossman says hugely profitable in 2012, yes, hugely profitable, because the expenses were zero. Any business would be hugely profitable if you didn't have to recognize your expenses. So in March of 2013, Mr. Scholem and Mrs. Scholem come to the scene and want to impose structure and the correct accounting for the way that expenses are really being spent and how they should be recognized. What we have shortly after that is two documents which are critical. They're exhibits 2 and 77. And in 2 and 77, these are dated May of 2013, the Scholems lay out the rules that they're going to live by, which are more strict, certainly far more strict than Bill Down had been using. If you use a truck to transport inventory, the local Detroit branch is going to pay for the gas. It's going to pay for the expense of the truck. If there are accounting staff people in Lansing who are performing accounting services for the Detroit branch is going to recognize the expense. And that's laid out for the first time in May of 2013 in a couple of emails in great detail. Following that, in Exhibit 18, in July of 2013, is the first of a series of what are called consent resolutions. And this happens every quarter. It's very formal. And it says, by consent, here's the amount we're going to be charging for the next 3 months of management fees, and with it is a spreadsheet that specifically goes through an individual's wages. 30% of the wages are going to be allocated. 9% of the software expense is going to be allocated to the Detroit branch. Mr. Castle has a hard time with that. And so starting in the middle of 2013, he and his son, who is a salesperson, are unhappy. In June of 2013, the next critical fact, Dave Castle, his son, who's the salesperson, talks to a competitor, Aerofilter, about potentially taking a job. And he mentions it to his father, Ed, in June of 2013. Ed says, I don't want to hear anything more about that. But he doesn't report to the Scholems, hey, this salesman, yes, it happens to be my son, but the salesman is so unhappy that he's thinking about leaving, maybe we ought to do something. Doesn't happen. He chooses his paternal instinct over his obligations as a member of the LLC. And that's understandable, but it puts him in a bit of a box because now he has his son unhappy. We go through the rest of 2013. The consent resolutions continue to come. There are more emails. There are offers to Mr. Castle. Ed, if you don't like these numbers, come to Lansing. Audit them. Come take a look. And at trial, Judge Viviano saw Ed Castle basically say, I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go. How could they make me drive to Lansing? How could they make me get an accountant? How could they dictate terms to me? They were bullies. That's what she heard at trial. And that's the personality conflict that had been simmering and developed starting in March of 2013. So we get through all of 2013. The consent resolutions continue to come. Mr. Castle doesn't do anything about them. He doesn't come to Lansing. He doesn't audit. He doesn't take anybody up on the offers. We get into early 2014. Same thing's happening. Now, here's where, to answer some of the questioning from earlier, there's an accounting issue that becomes relevant. Every year, because the company was showing some profit, there could have been distributions to the members of the LLC. That's what happens at the end of a calendar year in a limited liability company. You have a bank account, and in theory, you can make your distributions to your members. Every year, Dave and Ed, in February or March, would call up the CFO and say, hey, how much is our distribution? We want the cash. Every year, Midwest Air Filter would say, we're leaving the cash. We're not taking the cash. And that's what allowed the company to run with a bank account, is Midwest Air Filter was leaving its distributions in place. So in early 2014, Ed and Dave do the same thing. They clear out their cash. They have no more cash left, no more skin in the game, but Midwest Air Filter does. In mid-March 2014, the next critical fact, Dave decides he's going to leave. He has been interviewing with Aerofilter, and in the midweek of March, he comes to his father and says, I'm leaving, and by the way, will you take back the ownership of this company that you have gifted me over the years? And they sign a document that says Dave is transferring his interest back to Ed. Critical fact, if you're Ed and your salesperson has just announced to you this is happening, that's important. He doesn't tell the Sholms. Again, he chooses his paternal instinct. That's fine. Over the weekend, Dave actually leaves. On Sunday night, he's at a dinner with his dad, Ed. He tells Ed, I'm going to go tomorrow morning. I'm going to work for Aerofilter, a competitor. Ed doesn't call the Sholms, doesn't tell the Sholms, doesn't do anything. And starting in that week of March 17th of 2014, the relationship between these parties, as bad as it already was, went even worse. Because now, what does Ed do? He goes and hires the lawyer who's representing Dave, Liza Favera. She's representing Dave in the ongoing litigation about Dave stealing trade secrets. And Ed hires her in March or April. He refuses to help out competing head-to-head against his son, Dave. He goes on vacation for much of April. And when Jonathan Sholm sends them a list of basically help us out in the litigation type of questions, Ed Castle says, this is a witch hunt. I'm not answering any of your questions. He seems to be aligned with his son. By the end of March of 2014, it's obvious within the company that Ed has chosen Dave, his son, over the company, but Ed is still working there. So now we get into this issue of making a capital call and the settlement conversations. Those are in May of 2014. The company announces a capital call to Ed. It's based on the fact that the company is going to need cash. Sales have gone down because Dave has left. The company, which has been operating on this reserve that Midwest Air Filter left in place, Midwest Air Filter takes its reserve and says, we're going to play fair now. Everybody's in this company. We're not going to keep our reserve parked. Everybody's going to have to contribute cash. And they lay out the math. We've already contributed cash. Ed, you need to contribute cash. That's what the capital call says. Ed refuses. Ed hires a different lawyer.
So are you saying that Midwest's response to the capital call was what? What did they put in?
The capital call.
They were then accounting as their response to the capital call the reserves that they'd left in already?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
They didn't put in new money.
Okay.
So at trial, there were questions, fair questions of Jonathan Sholem about his accounting and his math and how he developed that math. That's fine. There was corporate counsel who assisted in the drafting of the capital call, and if there were issues at trial, cross-examination about the math and the distributions, so be it. Let's leave that off to the side. But to answer your questions from earlier, there was no new money put in. Midwest Air Filter was basically saying, we've put in a lot, you haven't put in anything, now we need money, you're a member, contribute your share. And that was the basis for the capital call. So Ed Castle has a different lawyer now named Paul Giugemelli, and there's a negotiation about, well, what's the math? So we send him the math. And then there's a discussion of a global release. Ed, you seem not to want to work here anymore. We can understand that. How about you leave? How about you sign a non-compete? And there's a whole bunch of terms. Ed says, no, not interested. That's in the middle of 2014. We move towards the latter half of 2014, and here's where the critical facts kind of come to a head. Ed is not training Dave's substitute, Amy Wilhelm. He's not responding to Jonathan Cholam's request for customer call reports. He's refusing to even tell anybody what his car insurance is because the car is a potential liability. And then, kind of incredibly, at the very end of 2014, he accuses Jonathan Cholam of trying to steal his business when Jonathan says, will you please, Ed, share with me what customers you're calling, who their phone, what their phone numbers are, when you made contact. We do this with all of our salespeople. You're a salesperson, and we're kind of concerned, by the way, that your son Dave is competing and you're not going head-to-head. Share with us what you're doing. Ed, who's a minority member, writes back and says, forget it. I'm not giving it to you. You're trying to steal my business. That's in November and December of 2014. Jonathan Cholam lays out in an email that is, I think, exhibits 74 and 76 are the two emails towards the end of 2014, a series of very straightforward business questions about car insurance, about a non-compete, about sales reports. Ed won't answer, stubbornly won't answer. Then, on December 1st, Jonathan sends the last of these emails, and it says, here's all the things I need from you. You need to do these things to keep your job, including sign a non-compete, because all my other people have non-competes. I'm really concerned that you're going to go over and compete with your, join your son. So if you're going to stick around, you have to sign a non-compete. Ed won't sign it. And Ed testifies that he knows at that moment he's at risk of losing his job, the part of his compensation package in the bigger picture of his membership that is tied to his work. No one would disagree with the premise that an employee such as Ed can be fired from their job for a variety of reasons, if, even if that employee is also a member of the LLC. If he happens to be an employee who steals, who doesn't perform, who won't sign a non-compete, who won't answer questions, who belligerently says, I'm not even going to answer because you're trying to steal my business, that the employer can fire the employee. Here's where it would be a problem, but it's not in this case. If Ed's salary was $500,000 a year, but a normal employee doing that job would have been $80,000, and he's fired from his $500,000 a year job, that looks a lot like you're starving him from his, of his profits in the business, because it's built into his wage artificially. But Ed is being paid a wage that matches his job. It's an $80,000 job. He's getting $80,000. So when he's fired, he doesn't keep his job benefit of $80,000, and the company hires somebody else to do his job, pays them the market wage. There's nothing about that activity that disproportionately impacts him as a member. He doesn't lose his voting power. He doesn't lose his right to distribution. If there's a profit in any year after that, he's still going to receive his percentage distribution as he's entitled to. So the claim in the case that arises out of the termination has two flaws. One is Midwest Air Filter / Filter Depot had every reason in the world to fire Ed Castle by December. It had laid out for him a series of conditions to keep his job. He hadn't met them, and he wouldn't go head-to-head and compete with his son in business. So Midwest Air Filter is losing business over the second half of the year 2014 because of it. Those, in real time, are the facts that led us to the end of 2014. There are no more facts after December 31st of 2014 that are all relevant for your analysis of this case. And what we know as a result of all those facts on the cross appeal is that the lower court made two mistakes. One has to do with whether Mr. Castle, Ed Castle, should be liable for damages for breaching his fiduciary duty to Filter Depot. Filter Depot says, Ed Castle, you knew that your son was leaving. You secretly even made a deal to pick up his ownership interest. You didn't protect the company at all in any positive way, and you refused to help out when the company was pursuing your son in litigation. You wouldn't answer questions. You wouldn't go head-to-head to compete with him, and you secretly had made this deal to pick up his ownership. All of those things, to us, are a breach of his fiduciary duty to the company. Judge Viviano's decision says, well, the company didn't prove that it lost the sales. There's no connection to the lost profit. But there was evidence from Jonathan Schoen, who's the one who can testify under the Ugansky case as an owner of the business, to exactly what happened. Dave threatened to leave. Dave said, I'm going to take $500,000 in sales. The sales actually went down roughly that number in the amount of time immediately after Dave left, and we know that Ed didn't do anything to protect the company against that eventuality. So that's the series of facts that were presented to Judge Viviano, and yet she decided there's no connection between Ed concealing all this and assisting his son and then the loss of profit to the company. That's the first error Judge Viviano made. It has to do with the breach of fiduciary duty. On the capital call, we believe Judge Viviano made a mistake because she invalidated the capital call. If you read through her decision, I can't explain how this happened. She said there's no 10-day notice in the capital call, but it's required. That's because Ed Castle testified at trial, I didn't get 10-day notice. But the capital call, on the face of it, that Judge Viviano apparently didn't read as she was drafting that part of her decision, says right in it, you have 10 days, Ed Castle. So we can move the 10-day notice out. So now what's left that would invalidate the capital call? Judge Viviano, at this point, it entered into an area of limited liability company law that I believe she just had some difficulty sorting out. And I'm going to explain it in kind of the most gentle way I can. There is, throughout LLC law, corporate law, something called a consent resolution. And it's when a majority has a majority, they don't need to have a meeting or a vote, and they pass something that's called a consent resolution, and they, with timely notice, give it to the minority and say, here's the consent resolution. We didn't hold a meeting. We didn't have a vote. We were going to vote you. What was the point? Here's a consent resolution. So the LLC operating agreement allows for that. Michigan law allows for that. We've given the court ICLE form LLC operating agreements. They all have this provision for consent resolutions. Judge Viviano decided that somehow that was inconsistent with the concept of voting and therefore invalid to use a consent resolution. You actually needed to have a vote because the operating agreement a couple paragraphs above that says there will be votes. Well, of course there will be votes, but 6.4, you can have a consent resolution if you've got the majority power. So what Judge Viviano did, I think, was improperly invalidate the capital call on the failure of this holding a meeting or vote without recognizing that a consent resolution is a legitimate way to have done what the majority did. Judge Viviano really didn't do what counsel suggests, which is dig into the weeds and say, your math is wrong, I don't see whether you contributed the money. She didn't get to that. She just said the format of the capital call is wrong based on this notice, based on the failure to describe what you're using the money for, based on the fact that it's not with a vote, and she invalidated it. Well, our position on the cross appeal is that those were errors, and as a result, the capital call is legitimate on its face, and if there's going to be a determination about whether the math was right, somebody might have to do that, but nobody's really done it yet. On that issue, to kind of close the loop of this part of the case, which is our cross-appeal, in his testimony, Mr. Castle couldn't have been clearer in his attitude and the language he used. He testified, and there's multiple versions of the same thing, but I'm quoting one. I don't have to answer this stuff to him, speaking about Jonathan Schoen. And that is why the succession failed. That's why these people don't get along. That's why they were fighting. But it doesn't justify an oppression case. It's just an explanation, a human explanation of why they were at each other's throats for as long as they were. Let me just spend a couple minutes talking about responding to the claim that there was oppression in the management fees, because the argument was they were funneling money. So let me give you an example that explains this in an easy way. If Midwest Air Filter decided to mow the lawns outside of its headquarters and paid itself $5,000 an hour to mow the lawns and said to Mr. Castle, oh, guess what? There's no money left in the bank. We just paid ourselves $5,000 an hour to mow the lawn. That is self-dealing. That is oppression. That's an easy one. If Midwest Air Filter hires itself to mow the lawn at the market rate, but it happens to be Midwest Air Filter that's doing the mowing, that's self-dealing, but it's not oppression because it's not unfair economically to the minority. The minority would have to pay somebody to mow the lawn. The fact that it happens to be Midwest Air Filter doesn't move it over into oppression. And many, many, many businesses, real estate businesses are a classic example where a component of the ownership might be the managers of the property, and they charge a fee out of rent. Well, they charge a fair fee, they're allowed to do it. They charge double the fee, they're not. So we go back to the facts I explained to you. Starting in May of 2013, every consent resolution and every email says to Mr. Castle, here's our math. Here's what we're doing. We're not hiding it. We're telling you exactly who the people are. We're telling you exactly the percentage. If we're using a snowplow company, we're telling you who it is and how much we're paying. And never once until he sued did he come in and say, I want to see the snowplow contract, or that seems high, that snowplow contract, or that seems high that you're using those people too much. And at trial, most significantly, every witness supported the fairness of these fees. The only testimony that was halfway there, contrary, was Carolyn Riedler, the expert for Mr. Castle. And the court can read Judge Viviano's decision, the court can read my briefs. Carolyn Riedler apparently was not retained to come to the ultimate conclusion, which is, were the fees unfair? She said, I don't have an opinion about whether they're fair or not fair. She said, I had some questions about some things, and it took me a while to gather the information. They stalled me on getting me the documents. I had to go to Lansing. She had some grievances, but they stopped short of, I also have an opinion that the fees are unfair. So Judge Viviano looks at the balance of the evidence, and she says, well, I've got all this evidence to support these fees, and I don't have anything saying they're unfair. Now, Mr. Rossman can say, well, that's sure a lot of money or whatever, but you're not here to, Mr. Rossman's not here to testify, and he wasn't at the trial as a witness. There was no witness. There is no testimony about a single one of these being unfair. In fact, Ms. Riedler backed up so quickly when she said, well, at one point I thought maybe allocating the expenses wasn't done correctly. It should have been done in 1/7 because there were 7 branches. And I cross-examined her. I said, well, that's kind of simplistic. She said, yeah, I guess it is kind of simplistic. And it was. And she didn't say, if you do it a different way, it's unfair. She just said, you could do it in these 1/7, but that's very simplistic. And that's kind of an example of how this trial went and why Judge Viviano, at the end of the day, when she wrote her opinion, says very clearly the evidence for Ms. Tremaine and the other two who testified about the backup for each one of these explained that these were actual costs being passed through on a fair basis. That's the defense to the claim that these were oppressive management fees. I want to just move quickly to the question, and I don't know how much.
8 minutes.
Okay. Let's talk about these other aspects of oppression. Mr. Rossman took a pretty academic approach, and I appreciate that. I mean, if he's given a seminar on it or whatever, that's fine. There's a lot of cases in the past 5 or 6 years, mostly unpublished from this court, about what is and what isn't oppression. And mostly, what's oppression is the kind of thing I was explaining to you, where the majority takes advantage of its situation to, as Mr. Rossman said, funnel money unfairly. Well, there's no evidence here of funneling money unfairly. So we're left with this kind of curious argument, and you noted it, Judge, which is that the we'll call it the aborted capital call could constitute oppression. Well, the capital call was generated based on a need for money. And it was presented to Mr. Castle. And he said, I'm not paying. We had to sue him for it. And at this point, Judge Viviano agrees with Mr. Castle. Now, I think you should reverse that. If you reverse it, it will be a valid capital call, and he has to pay the money. It can't be oppression. He owes the money. But if you don't reverse it and you leave Judge Viviano in place on that issue, we have an attempt to give somebody a capital call, and he says, I'm not going to pay. And he argues about the notice, and he argues about the language. And Judge Viviano essentially agrees with them and says, all right, you don't have to pay. The notice was bad. The language was bad. The timing was bad. You don't have to pay. All right. End of conversation about the capital call. It was an attempt. It was rebuffed. And this court may decide, end of story. Well, if so, it can't be oppression. And you ask Mr. Rossman, how can that be oppression? It can't be oppression to try what on the face of it looks like a legitimate capital call, get rebuffed, and at the end, call that oppression. It was an effort to impose a capital requirement on Mr. Castle for good reason. He had taken every bit of cash he could out of the company to that point. So it's a non-event legally. It was an effort. Second, Mr. Rossman says, well, they tried to negotiate to squeeze him, to put him in a corner and make him sign a settlement agreement. Well, he didn't sign it. This is mid-2014. Ed Castle's represented by Paul Sugamelli. There's a long-form release, including a non-compete and a whole bunch of things, and Mr. Castle says, I won't sign that. And he doesn't. That's the end of it. It can't be oppression to offer somebody a settlement agreement of terms that are in dispute, including a non-compete, and have the person say, no, I'm not interested, I have valid reasons, I won't sign it. End of story. That's not an oppressive act. That's actually an attempt by the company to sort out a dispute that should be encouraged, which is to say to Mr. Castle, we're fighting with you. Here's some terms we would agree on to get you out of our hair and us out of your hair, which he says no to. Okay, he says no. He's allowed to say no. Those two actions, though, can't contribute to any finding of oppression. They were negotiations with lawyers involved, and Mr. Castle staked out his position and said, I'm not going to do those things. The concept that there was confusion at that point about who owed how much money, and Judge Stevens, you had some questions about the loan and the accounting. So these came up at that same period of time, and these are related back to the question of the capital call and what the math showed. And again, I want to highlight why this is a red herring. Ms. Riegler originally came up and testified at trial. There's this $96,000 entry on the tax returns that I just don't get. It seems backwards. Fine. If you read, pages 4 to 6 of my cross-appeal reply brief, you'll see we went through that. And at the end, she says, okay, I get it now. I understand. It was just an accounting thing on the tax return. It was backwards. But I understand what the true import was, which is, as I told you at the beginning, Midwest Air Filter parked its distributions every year and left the money in the bank. And so what the accountant mistakenly showed up as a receivable or a loan wasn't really either of those things. It was clarified. Ms. Riegler appreciated it was clarified.
What do you call it when you do that?
It is, for accounting purposes, there is cash on hand in an LLC, but there's already been a distribution.
Isn't that taxable then?
So here, what? Yes, and actually, so here's the way it would
work. I'm just thinking about it from my own.
Yes.
When I had a PLC, right. Which I can't imagine it's all that different.
It's the same. And okay. This is exactly why Ed and Dave in March would call up Ted Heitsche, who was the CFO, and say, hey, Ted, our K-1 we just got,
right.
And it shows our $30,000 profit for last year. Is there 30 in the bank? We want our 30. We have to pay taxes on our 30.
Sure.
And they actually get their check for 30. They can pay their taxes. Every year that happened, Midwest Air Filter would not take actual cash for that. It would leave the money parked until the very end, 2013.
Yeah, but then the other partners or the other shareholders would pay the taxes on that.
No,
right?
Because it's an LLC. It's a pass-through. It's a partner. It's
okay.
Taxed as a partnership. So there's no corporate tax at that level.
Okay, all right.
And
okay.
That's why right. In most LLCs, if it's people who are prudent about their tax planning, they actually do mostly drain the bank account at the end of every calendar year,
right.
Because there's no point to hold in the distribution,
exactly.
Unless you need it in the business for the forthcoming year, and then you will. You hold it because you might have to buy something or you might have to pay somebody a salary. If you draw your bank account always down to zero, you then kind of by definition...
Then you have to loan it.
You have to loan it.
Loan it back the next. But okay, maybe this is a difference, and it's a tax question. It's really off. But I always thought that you did have to pay the taxes on whatever you left in.
Well, you pay tax based on the K-1, which says the distribution to you, which may not yet be cash. So okay. Ed and Dave, when they get their K-1, it says $30,000. They haven't yet received $30,000.
Okay.
But the profit of the company is $30,000. That's their share.
Right. Okay,
so they do have to pay tax on the $30,000, right. But they don't have
Thank
the money.
You. Thank you.
All right. So that's what happens. So at the end of this, the oppression claim, the final segment of the oppression claim that I want to leave us with is this termination issue. Because the claim is that Mr. Rossman identified it correctly. Under Michigan law, which has evolved, a member who's also an employee doesn't have immunity. They don't have immunity from being fired if they don't do their job just because they happen to be a member. The statute is written so that, in fact, termination is okay. It's okay as long as it doesn't disproportionately affect the membership interest. And it's okay because sometimes you have members of LLCs who deserve to be fired. And they shouldn't be able to come to court and say, I'm protected because I'm a member from being fired. Remember, he's an at-will employee. He doesn't have an employment contract. He doesn't have a claim for wrongful termination in this case. He doesn't. He never filed one. He didn't have one for wrongful termination. He couldn't. He was at will. All he has is a claim that the firing constituted oppression under the statute. And the difficulty with that claim in this case is the legislature has already said you might be fired as an employee and not have an oppression claim. So identify some things that were disproportionate on your membership interest that are the result of your firing. And that's why Mr. Rossman was doing his best to identify for you some things that he thought were disproportionate impacts on Mr. Castle that came out of his termination. That's why when I mentioned this earlier, I suggested one such example would be if his salary was inflated to account for his membership interest. So when he's fired, he's actually losing his profit distributions as part of his salary. That could be a disproportionate impact. But that's not what happened here. There was never any evidence that Mr. Castle's salary was higher than a market rate. So what Mr. Rossman is left with is his involvement somehow ended. But there was no evidence of that at the trial. What happened was Mr. Castle is a minority member subject to being outvoted on any number of issues. We thought enough of the conflict to file a motion to dissolve this business. A dissolution would have separated them, allowed them to figure out the assets and liabilities, split everything up. Mr. Castle opposed dissolution, and Judge Viviano agreed. So they're in bed with each other, and they are now. So the argument that Mr. Castle makes, which is somehow he's no longer been involved or he can't operate or can't do anything, is inconsistent with his position as a minority member of an LLC. And that's the cause. If he's outvoted, it's because he's being outvoted as the majority has the power to do.
Your time's expired.
Okay. If there are any
Thank
questions.
You. Any questions?
No.
No? Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes.
You know, it occurred to me when when my opposing counsel indicated something about the market rate and how he created a test for disproportionate impact whereby a shareholder receiving some kind of salary in excess of market rate is evidence of there being no disproportionate impact. And when he said the word market, it occurred to me that it was the first time he said that. And it was a word that wasn't set down in the trial court either, which was interesting because under the entire fairness standard and specifically the Phil Buildings precedent, which is very good law in Michigan, one of the standards there was whether an insider deal, there was evidence of there being market rates, market comps, negotiated terms, entire fairness. There wasn't a scintilla of evidence, even though it was their burden. When you're dealing with self-dealing, under the statute, it puts the burden on the self-dealer to prove entire fairness. And we didn't have any evidence of there being any attempt to present evidence that what they were charging the Filter Depot was somehow commensurate with the services that could have been solicited on the open market. Why did Filter Depot have to use Midwest Air Filter? Why did the majority require that? And so I would urge the court to apply that analysis to the evidence here, which the court didn't do. The court ignored that precedent and found just ipso facto, because there's a cost computation and it's just a pass-through, that somehow they're fair. Well, what if the costs are out of control? If I go to a vendor for, I don't know, copy machines or telephones, and they're basing their price to me on their internal cost, and it's through the roof, and I go out on the open market and I find something. Here, there's no evidence of market comparability. Mr. Frank said that it was a sweetheart deal because the Filter Depot was paying zero. Not true. They were paying 2% for about 13 years plus transportation fees. And why is it that the Filter Depot should be treated as one of Midwest Air Filter's divisions? There's six divisions, and they treated the Filter Depot as a seventh division. That's not the case. The Filter Depot is a separate company. It's entitled to an arm's-length deal, not a seven-company division allocation. It's false that Dave told Ed months earlier that he was going to work for this competitor. The first time he told him, and this is in the transcript on page 110 and 11, and it's in my brief, was on that Friday night. He said he hadn't quite decided what he was going to do yet. He gave the assignment to Mr. Castle, and he said, hold on to this, I haven't made my final decision. On Sunday night, he made his final decision, and Ed let his son do what a father should let his son do, which is go break the news himself. There's nothing that could have been done over the weekend. And in fact, the record is clear, and this is at on the May 18th trial transcript, page 111, where Jonathan Shoham testified that on Mr. Castle's termination, at the time of his termination, Mr. Castle's sales were up. So while Mr. Shoham would have, you know, as a pretense, you know, all these reasons to fire Mr. Castle, there's no question that his sales were up. He was, what does he want him to do other than do as much as he can for his sales? And the record is clear that Mr. Shoham directed Mr. Castle to not call on Dave's customers. Just don't go call on him. So he criticizes him for going on vacation. The money was not set aside. The money was always in Midwest Air Filter's bank account. So when there's this argument that, oh, distributions weren't taken, and somehow, even though it's not documented, we're entitled to declare those 5 years later our capital contributions, the money had always been sitting in Midwest Air Filter's bank account. And I'll divert briefly. Other money that was sitting in Midwest Air Filter's bank account was a $50,000 settlement paid by Mr. Castle's son in settlement of the lawsuit that was commenced against him. So, and this is indicative of how they view these companies and the commingling, and why commingling in the case law is always viewed as such a problem. The Filter Depot paid Mr. Frank a substantial attorney fee to go after Dave Castle. He goes after him, the case settles. I think it was about $100,000+ in attorney fees. Settles for $50,000. Where's the money go? Into the Midwest bank account. It doesn't even get onto the books of the Filter Depot. On page 19 of my brief, turning back to the question of whether distributions were taken, Cindy LeMain, the company's CPA, testified that in 2013, Midwest took a distribution from Filter Depot in the amount of $641,506, as confirmed by the K-1 statement to Midwest. And that's it. The 518 trial transcript, page 66, and is further shown in Exhibit 69.
Counsel, your time's up.
So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Questions? Thank you. Case is submitted. Number 8340366.